content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We'll begin today with the second half of a story entitled "The Allies Left a Mess in the Ocean" by Paul Hawkanes. I read the first half of this story at the end of last week's episode. More than a half a century after the fighting ended, the task of addressing the environmental danger and risk to life from dumped munitions has become its own battle. When Dieter Gulden entered the field of munitions cleanup in 2000, he saw the problem's enormity and malevolent power as the ultimate challenge for his technical imagination. 57-year-old Gulden describes himself as a pacifist by nature and an archaeologist by training. He touched bases with an old friend, Edgar Schwab, a geophysicist who was in Hamburg, Germany, and one step ahead of his buddy, starting up a little company to appropriate the lethal relics of the Third Reich from the ocean floor. The two friends were interested in digging less to explain humanity's past than to undo the damage that had been inflicted upon nature, and together they co-founded C-Terra. Gulden immersed himself in the history of munitions dumping in Northern Europe, a practice that was discontinued worldwide only in 1975. While C-Terra's incendiary devices While C-Terra conscientiously cleared patches of seafloor for industry, the massive munitions across the greater seafloor gnawed at him. He insisted that his country clean it up so that future generations wouldn't suffer this legacy of wars executed by generations past. He worked the halls of power for 10 years, but couldn't get officialdom to touch the odious issue. The fact that the seafloor was littered with munitions has been a common knowledge since 1945, but no one knew exactly how much there was or where. C-Terra and a smorgasbord of concerned groups, including Strachey's Institute, understood that before anybody was going to address the issue, they first had to find out exactly what they were dealing with. In the course of its work for private companies, C-Terra began developing technology, such as a prototype crawler, the Deep Sea, for surveying the seafloor meter by excruciating meter. In the deep and churning North Sea, with its muscular tidal currents, much of the detritus lies meters beneath the seafloor. To penetrate the sediment, C-Terra developed underwater drones and advanced multi-beam radar equipment. For shallow tidal areas, C-Terra also created low-flying drones outfitted with magnetic sensors that can detect metallic masses buried deep in the sand. Many of C-Terra's innovations entailed modifying technology used in related fields such as mining, pyrotechnics, and archaeology. The team started with a lot of energy but few resources. In the beginning, we used zip ties and duct tape for everything, Gulden says. The range of state-of-the-art technology the team now operates is not the brainchild of one person, but Gulden has been central to much of it. Now, with a firm grasp of the problem and how to address it, Gulden and others at C-Terra are itching to display their accumulated know-how in the Bay of Lübeck. "The time has now come," he announced recently on LinkedIn. "We, the explosive ordnance disposal companies, can now start our real work to make the oceans cleaner and to measure our ideas and concepts against the physical reality of this blight." "It is," his announcement says, "a great success for the company and a recognition of our many years of effort in developing new technologies and concepts for explosive ordnance at sea." Aboard the Alcor, scientists believe that their star, the Norpa 300, is ready for official deployment in the Bay of Lübeck. The crawler is an accumulation of years of invention, testing, and tweaking. Unlike previous undersea robots, it operates at depths up to 300 meters and can do so 24/7, even in turbulent waters. Its many functions will relieve professional divers of some of the cleanup expedition's most perilous tasks. The robot is equipped with sonar and acoustic imaging for detecting and identifying buried munitions. Its detachable arms include a custom-designed vacuum that gingerly hoovers sediment from buried explosives and a pincher for lifting pieces of ammunition. The cleanup process for weapons that can be handled will involve three general steps using specialized ships. First, Cetera's engineers and scientists on the Alcor, the survey vessel, will scan the site and classify the munitions. They will also take water samples for GeoMar to analyze on board, distinguishing conventional from chemical weaponry. Chemical weapons which contain phosgene, arsenic, and sulfur mustard, also known as mustard gas, are too lethal to handle, probably ever, Goulden admits. You can't see these gases or smell them, he says, and their detonation could blow a ship out of the water, killing a ship's entire crew in a matter of minutes. Those weapons will be left untouched. Kunitzer of the German Environment Agency adds that the Nazis' nerve gases were designed to incapacitate the eyes, skin, and lungs of battlefield foes. Decades underwater doesn't dilute their potency, she says. If the experts determine that the material is safe enough for transportation, they'll deploy the NORPA 300 to collect and deposit smaller items, such as grenades, into undersea wire mesh baskets. But if the explosive specialists monitoring from the ship above determine that the weaponry still contains detonators, divers, not a robot, will be sent to detach them. This is a hazardous business that, thus far, only humans can execute. Next, a different team on a second ship, the clearance vessel, equipped with spud legs, stakes that hold the ship in place, will use hydraulic crane equipped with cameras to extract larger munitions, including those with corrupted casings, and drop them into undersea receptacles. The final step is for a third team to haul the cargo onto the deck of their ship, the sorting vessel, to sort, label, and package the lethal concoctions in steel tubes, then transport them to an interim site in the Baltic Sea. There, the material will be resunk in the tubes and stored underwater until it can be handed over to the responsible state authority, the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Service, for demolition. The workers will have 2 months to clear the bay and demonstrate that the NORPA 300 and other technologies are either up to it or not. But a hitch will delay the destruction of all the recovered weapons for about a year. Germany has a single major munitions disposal facility, and it is occupied with incinerating unexploded ordnances from across the globe, not least, incredibly, Nazi-era explosives still being unearthed from construction sites. That's why the Bay of Lübeck project budget includes construction of a disposal facility. The company and concept have yet to be finalized. One option is to build a floating clearance platform where robots will dissect ordnance and burn the chemical contents in a detonation chamber at temperatures of more than 1,300 degrees Celsius, similar to how weapons are disposed of at the land-based facility. There's another snafu, too. Over the years, the mounds of weaponry in the undersea dumping grounds have corroded and collapsed into one another, creating a gnarled, combustible mass of metals and explosive agents that make their recovery more complicated. The only options are to leave these or blow them up on site. The best-case scenario is that all of the Baltic's most hazardous conventional munitions will finally be history by 2050, and the work on the North Sea will be well underway. The worst case is that the funding does not materialize, and mountains of explosives will continue to deteriorate in en masse, emitting poisons. Before the green light can come to start the cleanup, Goulden was becoming doubtful that his country would ever address the mess. The thought that he might accept that Cetera's expertise would never be put to the greater task that he and Schwab had envisioned. For the foreseeable future, at least, he'll be on be in on the thick of culminating his life's work, undoing some of humanity's sins on the seafloor. Our second article, Why Didn't Facing a Common Enemy Bring Us Together? By Francis S. Collins. Collins is the former director of the National Institutes of Health and the author of The Road to Wisdom on Truth, Science, Faith, and Trust. Can you remember the early months of COVID-19? We humans are wired somehow to suppress truly horrible memories. Unless I force myself to go back and look at the notes or media reports from that year, I find it hard to remember just how awful it was. In many urban settings, hospital emergency rooms were overwhelmed with the sick and dying. ICUs were unable to handle the demand, and the morgues were overflowing. As director of the National Institutes of Health, it was my job to marshal all possible resources to focus on rapid development of vaccines, drug treatments, and diagnostic tests. Vaccines generally require many years to develop, so much of 2020 was fraught with uncertainty about what exactly was going to happen in our world. We assembled the world's scientific experts, convinced partners in government, academia, and industry to drop their usual legalistic skepticism about each other's contributions, design master protocols that would ensure that any trials of vaccines and therapeutics would be rigorous and definitive, and set up a shark tank to test bold ideas about how to make home testing for COVID-19 easy and accurate. It was a year of no sleep. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's development of a COVID test ran into serious problems, and public health recommendations got off to a rocky start. There wasn't much data to go on, and this was a genuine crisis. Public health agencies were doing the best they could with inadequate information. Initial recommendations included some confusing information about masks not being necessary. But then, once it became clear that the virus could be readily transmitted by people who had no symptoms, the CDC reversed course and recommended that masks should be worn. The recommendation was correct, but the reasoning was not always made clear. One strong motivation for the recommendations in the spring of 2020 was to, quote, flatten the curve, to delay the number of new infections so that the overwhelmed hospitals would not go completely under. Temporary school and university closures were put in place to try to reduce transmission. Given the lower risk of serious illness in children and young adults, the concern was only partly about their health. It was about preventing infected kids and young adults from bringing the disease home to vulnerable parents and grandparents. Similarly, seeking to reduce acute transmission, closures of many businesses and a limitation on mass gatherings were instituted in early 2020, though the rigidity of the rules varied a lot across the country. Today, many argue that these measures in the first few months of the pandemic were too draconian. Some even say they did more harm than good. But a detailed 2021 evidence-based analysis of the outcomes of flatten-the-curve measures in 41 countries showed that most of them provided benefit in reducing transmission during the first wave of the pandemic. Of the various measures, closing schools and universities and limiting gatherings to 10 people or fewer had the most significant effect. Closing non-essential businesses delivering personal services, like gyms and hair salons, had a moderate effect. Targeted closures of face-to-face businesses with a high risk of infection, like restaurants, bars, and nightclubs, had a small to moderate effect. Adding a stay-at-home order provided only a small additional benefit to those other measures. Those are the data. But there were trade-offs. Without question, harms were also done by these public health measures, particularly in less populated areas, and those began to mount as the months went by. The school closures were supposed to be temporary, but because the alarm about the risks of transmission had already been raised, it became hard for parents, teachers, and public health officers across the country to retreat from these recommendations, despite the growing potential harm to children's learning and socialization. In some locations, weeks turned into months or dragged into a second year. Similarly, business closures that were extended over long periods created a great deal of economic stress for millions of people, especially among hourly workers and those in rural communities. Public trust in the government began to fray. Mixed messages from the White House, including truly outrageous comments from the commander-in-chief about injecting bleach to treat COVID-19, did not help. As a physician and an NIH director at that time, I was totally focused on trying to advance the science of both vaccines and therapeutics. Yet I was increasingly aware that the public was becoming frustrated and distrustful of the actions we were pursuing. I believe that history will recognize the development of vaccines in just 11 months as one of humanity's finest health achievements. Based on the analysis by the Commonwealth Fund, as of 2022, more than 18 million hospitalizations and 3 million deaths were prevented in the United States alone. But at the same time, the distrust that had been building during 2020 and early 2021 led to a decision by about 50 million Americans to pass up the vaccine. An assessment by the Kaiser Family Foundation concludes that distrust of the safety and efficacy of COVID vaccines caused more than 230,000 needless deaths in the U.S. alone. People of faith were particularly hard hit by misinformation. White evangelical Christians, my own group, were the most resistant to the most resistant demographic of all, worried about the rumors that the vaccines contained tracking chips or represented the mark of the beast from the book of Revelation. Political partisanship also played a major role. A recent cross-sectional study in two states, Ohio and Florida, showed that the rate of death in those states was strongly associated with political party affiliation. After May 2021, when the vaccines were freely available to all adults, the death rate for Republican voters was 43% higher than for Democratic voters. The long echo of the negative public response to COVID-19 has led to greater resistance in all forms of vaccination, putting children at risk for diseases such as measles and polio that had almost been eradicated in the developed world. This may be the most consequential example of distrust of science in modern history. We are in serious trouble when some believe that their faith requires them to distrust science, or when others believe that political allegiances are a better source of wisdom than truth, faith, or science. Something deep within our culture is wrong. In many aspects of our daily discourse, the links among truth, science, faith, and trust seem to have been broken. But before blaming all of this on other sources of misinformation and disinformation, I have to point the finger at myself and my other colleagues as well. Our communication was not always as clear or as helpful as it needed to be. We often did a poor job of explaining the emerging nature of our understanding. People like me were aware of how uncertain our picture of the virus was on any given day, but we didn't always convey that in public statements. We should have said, today's recommendation is the best we can do based on current evidence. The information is changing quickly, and the recommendations next week need to be different. There are many examples where the story had to evolve, but that often surprised and frustrated the public. We didn't know at first that asymptomatic people could be infectious. The related coronavirus diseases, SARS and MERS, weren't like that. Once we learned that, we had to recommend that everyone wear masks indoors. But for reasons for the change were not clear to most people. The conclusion that the original vaccine preparations would not have the durability we had hoped for, they would have to be re-engineered, and another round of boosters would be needed. We urgently need to learn from what happened here. The worst pandemic in more than a century, driven by a dangerous and highly contagious virus, should have energized and unified us. COVID was the real enemy, but instead the pandemic tore us apart. False claims gained a rapid foothold, and the sources that were supposed to share objective information, admit uncertainty, and inspire public trust often failed to achieve that. Seeing this situation, people put most of their trust in other sources of even more questionable value, especially social media. All of this would be unfortunate if we were debating opinions about which baseball team is best. But with COVID, this was life or death, and for 230,000 Americans, it turned into tragic and unnecessary death. This loss of an anchor to facts and evidence should never have happened in a society based upon reason and knowledge. If we are serious as individuals and communities about traveling down the road to wisdom, we have a lot of lessons to learn, whether in dealing with the next pandemic, addressing climate change, or defending democratic elections. There are profound reasons for each of us to engage. It is crucial to see that what we are fighting for is great and glorious and worth every bit of the effort from each of us. Truth, science, faith, and trust are not just sources of relief from a painful period in our country's life. They represent the grandest achievements and insights of human civilization. They literally hold out the promise of a better life for every person on this planet, in material terms, in spiritual terms, and in social and cultural terms. To give up on them would be to give up on humanity's potential. To fight for them would not just be not just to fight for against divisiveness and ignorance, but to fight for a brighter future for all of us. To take up this challenge would therefore be an act not born of exhaustion or desperation, but one arising from the hopeful pursuit of the promise of greater flourishing of our entire human family. Our next article, Poland's Gift to the American Republic, was written by Timothy Schneider. This article is adapted from the author's new book on freedom. Whether the American Republic survives could be decided in the next few weeks. What does it feel like to watch a republic die, and what does it take to revive one? Decades or centuries hence, the signs will seem clear. Today we live through one of those moments when we feel the weight of our own decisions, powerful as they might be, remain elusive in our daily life. This is what I was thinking walking along Delaware Avenue to attend the Democratic National Convention in Chicago last month, when I found blocking my path a snowplow named Kazimir Plawowski. The machine, brought into summer service to assist in crowd control, was christened Plawowski earlier this year by Chicagoans in a popular vote. To name Department of Streets and Sanitation equipment after an 18th century hero of America's Revolutionary War is a whimsy of democracy. Without that snowplow's more accurately spelled namesake, Kazimierz Pulaski, there might not have been a Democratic National Convention, no Chicago, no United States of America even. The Revolutionary War was a close-run thing, and would almost certainly have been lost without the aid of revolutionaries from abroad. Pulaski, an experienced Polish military officer, organized the American cavalry and very possibly prevented the capture or death of George Washington at the Battle of Brandywine. Chicago, in fact, has an intersection of Pulaski and Washington streets. Without the encounter of these two men in life, their fight against tyranny would likely have failed. As politicians make freedom central to their election campaigns this fall, it is tempting to think nostalgically about the Revolution of 1776 and the War for Independence, to glorify the Founding Fathers. But we are not at a revolutionary moment. Instead, the choice is between decay and reform. Today's contest is still, thanks to the democracy that Pulaski and his comrades in arms bequeathed us, one fought with ballots, not bullets, but the stakes are no less consequential. The Republic will either be revived or perish, and the events in Poland that brought Pulaski and other Republican compatriots to America should be a cautionary tale for the modern nation he helped create. Pulaski, like other Poles in the 1770s, hoped for an American Republic to live because he was watching the Polish Republic perish. Pulaski was a veteran of wars with Russia. Catherine the Great, a German princess, had usurped the Russian imperial throne after the murder of her husband in a coup d'etat in 1762. Catherine's plans for imperial expansion included the destruction of the old Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, sometimes known as the First Polish Republic. A former lover of hers had been elected king of Poland, and her ambassador in Warsaw was arresting her political enemies. Pulaski joined a group of Polish patriots who chose to meet the Russian threat on the battlefield. The Polish rebels won some battles in 1768, but soon fell back on desperate tactics, including kidnapping the king. Implicated in the conspiracy, however, Pulaski had to flee to France. There he was discovered by Benjamin Franklin and decided to fight for the United States. Pulaski's decision to go into exile was fortunate. After the rebels were defeated in 1772, the three neighboring regimes partitioned Poland, each taking territory. Russia was ruthless. Poles who had fought for their country were branded and sent to Siberian exile. The Polish Republic was finished by foreign intervention, but its long, slow decline had domestic roots. Though much lauded then and since, not at least for the duration of more than two centuries, the republic system had a basic flaw, the tremendous inequality in status and wealth. The greater part of the population was enserfed, bound to the land. Most of the serfs, though, were owned by a few wealthy families, known as magnates, who controlled the economy and dominated the parliament. The turmoil generated by the flaws of the two republics spread onward through the 19th century. The naturalization of slavery in the United States Constitution certainly hindered not only the revolutionary generation, but also its heirs. The next great American rebellion was centrally in defense of slavery. At the same time, in 1863, when Polish nobles rebelled against Russian rule, some did so to preserve serfdom, which had been abolished in the Russian Empire. Aside from the inherent moral horror of human bondage, the social habits of rationalized inequality made political institutions weaker and righteous causes less persuasive. This inherent problem prevented any Polish rebellion in the 19th century from achieving a truly united national character. The peasants could imagine that a Russian victory might help them, just as many enslaved Americans in the 1770s or the 1810s had hoped for a British victory over the United States. The flaws of the Polish system were obvious to the early Republican Americans, who applauded when a new Polish constitution in 1794 removed them. But then Russia invaded again, precisely because the prospect of Polish democracy posed a threat to the Russian autocracy. This, of course, is the fundamental reason Russian President Vladimir Putin seeks today to destroy Ukraine, because a democratic Ukraine would threaten his story that only autocracy is possible. Today, with the flaws of the American system are all too apparent, its constitutional pressure points amplified by partisan misinterpretation based on ill will and supported by oligarchs and foreign foes. As is the story of our Polish allies reminds us, the problems of injustice were inscribed from the beginning, the Republic's unfulfilled promise of freedom. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 912-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.